Don't you know we're talking about a revolution? Sounds
It's Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown. I'm your host, Walt Keeson, here with co-host Bill Westmiller. Today is Thursday, April 11th, 2013, and here are some of the headlines we will be looking at today. We'll take a look at teen unemployment. It's a major problem. It doesn't get a lot of attention, particularly in this country like it should, but we're going to talk about it, and we're going to also look at a couple of different ways of measuring inflation. We're going to check back in with Obamacare, find out what's going on there, and Bill's got a interesting story about homeschool, and a really sad one, actually, about somebody who came here to homeschool and being deported for it. Plus, he's got a look at commerce on Google and a rather funny Google news story to talk about. But we're going to start with the stock market, because the stock market is actually closing in on $15,000. And everybody should say, woohoo, right, Bill? I mean, this is good news, supposedly, isn't it?
Yeah, Bill, it's new highs all around. And, of course, politicians want everybody to think that this is indicates that we've got a boom economy on the way. But if you look at the back and the backstory of what is actually going on, most of the stock market increases are because large corporations are the only ones who can borrow money, and they're getting it at ridiculously low interest rates, and they're buying back their own stock. So they're investing in their own companies, taking stock out of the market, so the price has to go up. So people are turning toward the capital gains as the advantage rather than dividends or profits. So it's it's partially a consequence of the Fed pushing the interest rates way down, and the banks are now anxious to loan money, but they have new requirements under the law in terms of what money they can lend to who. Well, obviously, the biggest corporations, the S&P 500, are creditworthy 99% of the time. So they're the ones that are borrowing money, and they're buying their own stock with it. So it's an interesting push. I mean, yeah, it's a push that's happening that doesn't reflect anything else in the economy. There isn't any increase in employment. There isn't any increase in nominal income. There isn't any increase for anybody. The only people who are benefiting from the way the situation has been set up by the Fed are the big corporations. So it's corporatism putting lots of bucks in their pockets, and everybody else is kind of hoping they can pick the corporation that's going to borrow the most money and get out before it crashes.
It's also it's a great way to do financing. I mean, if you have a large business and you want to finance, you normally have to consider either going deep into debt at higher interest rates than what we currently have. That's what you would normally have to do, or you have to issue stock. But now you have the best of both worlds. You can do a new stock issue. You can get that stock out of the market, collect the money on it, and then you can borrow all that money at ridiculously low rates, buy all the stock back, and now you basically have a cheap loan to fund your entire business. That's a pretty cool business scheme.
It isn't quite that simple. but no, I mean, there are different companies that are, doing it in different ways, but most of them have been buying back stock at a unprecedented pace over the past 6 months, because they can borrow money for next nothing, and their business is still thriving. They're making profits and expanding, and the rest of the money just goes into capital appreciation.
Yeah, unfortunately, it also gives bad signals, because, as you pointed out, it makes everybody think that what we really have is financial happiness.
As I pointed out last week, they talk about these new highs, but they're talking about nominal highs. They're not taking into account inflation.
No.
So the actual record highs on the Dow and things like that are just recoveries from where it was, in 2008. So it's It looks good. That's the key thing for politicians. It looks good.
Well, not only for politicians, it's also the key thing for, you know, anybody who speaks out on financial issues from a major position, because none of them speak out on these issues from the perspective of, hey, we need to have level steady money supply. Hey, we need to have a system that's actually fair to everybody. They're all speaking out in terms of, hey, if the big guys are doing well, it must be good.
Yeah. Well, another analyst, fund manager, pointed out that the whole market, there isn't any specific bubble. The whole market is a bubble.
Mm.
He's saying the problem, in my view, is the absence of a bubble in any individual sector. Instead, it's a bubble in profit margins across the entire corporate sector. And that's partially because they're laying off people and not hiring and squeezing the best efficiency they can out of what they've got, and simultaneously borrowing money to buy back stock. So, the corporate owners are making money hand over fist because their stock options are going up and, you know, everything's keen. But it's this subliminal bloating that the Fed is doing that nobody sees, except, you know, occasionally they notice prices rising on various things, and then we'll talk about the CPI.
Mm-hmm.
But the money goes from the Fed to the banks, and from the banks, the money is getting loaned out to the most creditworthy customers, which are the corporations. And they're borrowing the money and creating this huge, you know, debt bubble across the board, and mostly rebuying their own stock.
So it's a great racket.
Yep. Yeah. See, if we were a big corporation, we'd be in peachy keen. We wouldn't want to tell anybody about these things.
Of course, we'd be hated, but, you know, you can't have everything. Well, of course, all this prosperity happens in the midst of downtimes, because that's the way things work these days. When things are up, they're down. And the biggest indicator of that is the fact that unemployment keeps dropping, but nobody seems to be getting any jobs.
Well, they're all giving up.
That one.
That's very simple. Somebody pointed out at one of the hearings the other day that the number of people in the labor pool had fallen below what it was in 1985 or some weird number like that. You know, nobody wants to work.
They've all retired.
Yeah.
You know,
just that they're retiring, it's that they're,
stock,
you know.
Right? The stock that the corporations were bidding up the price on, so they all own the stock. They all cashed out, and now they're living in Tahiti.
There you go. Buying bitcoins.
Well, they won't be rich very long, but... But we actually have a couple... about unemployment. Why don't we take a look at the one you have first, because you have one that's probably the more dire of the two, talking about teen unemployment.
Yeah. Well, we had talked last week about the fact that the teen unemployment has been shown to increase directly with the increase in the minimum wage. So that has kind of fallen by the wayside along with everything else. But this particular article was talking about the monetary policy creating this boom bust cycle. The young people wouldn't be having any problems if it was anywhere near the minimum wage, you know, that it was, discarding inflation, that it was 10 years ago. But everything's got everything screwed up so bad that the entrepreneurship is being discouraged. And there are more regulations, and there's more government influence in economics, and that the lack of new businesses, the lack of small businesses being profitable, has a disproportionate influence on the number of young people who are working. Teen unemployment is something in the neighborhood, it varies from state to state, but anywhere from 11 to 18%. Compared with the overall number, which is still in the seven highs on the average.
That's the massaged number.
How's that?
That's the massaged number. That's the number after they've applied all the massaging to make it look better than it really is.
Well, after they've taken out all the people who are no longer looking, of course, the definition of people looking is people who have filed for unemployment and filed paperwork showing that they were searching for a job. And they have to do that on a monthly basis. I was on it several years ago. And you have to say, well, I applied to this company and that company, so on and so forth. And they just got tired of doing that after 2 years of not getting any jobs. Said, the heck with it. I'm not going to do this paperwork every month.
And so
they dropped out of the market. Or they went on welfare.
In addition to that, I mean, you're absolutely right. That's where a lot of the kind of falls through the cracks. But what I was also referring to is the fact that they calculate the employment based on a little survey that they do. They basically do some surveying to find out, kind of like a public opinion poll, who's looking for work. And then they know that since they're working with a small sample, they have to, account for the old margin of error and all that kind of stuff. So they massage the numbers. They make the numbers look better based on, what past numbers were and so forth. So you end up with something that, it's a nice steady flow of numbers. You don't see jumps going up and down or anything like that. It must be accurate.
They do a household survey, and of course, people who don't have enough money for a phone don't get surveyed.
They never get figured that one out.
I think it's every other month they survey small businesses. Of course, they call the ones that are still in business, not the ones that folded.
And it's kind of silly when you think about it. Why would you want to actually survey a business? They already have a job.
That's true. At least until Obamacare comes into effect, and then they're all going to just close down shop and say, forget it.
Fair enough to think about that. Well, we'll talk about that in a moment, too. But it isn't, of course, just the teens, the young people who are suffering, although they're suffering probably disproportionate to the rest of the population. But it's actually influencing people in all ranges. In fact, there's a article that I picked up off of FoxNews.com, which I normally don't like to go to because I don't like the heavy slant they often have, but this one was pretty good. And I just want to read a little bit from it because it brings it down to a single human-level perspective that really helps us get a sense of what's really going on out there. It says, after a full year of fruitless job hunting, Natasha Baylor just gave up. She'd already abandoned hope of getting work in her field, working with the disabled, but she couldn't land anything else either. Not even a job interview at a telephone call center. Until she feels confident enough to send out resumes again, she'll get by on food stamps and disability checks from Social Security and lives with her parents in St. Louis. I'm not proud of it, says Babler, who is in her mid-30s and is blind. The only way I'm able to sustain any semblance of self-preservation is to rely on government programs that I have no desire to be on. Babler's frustrating experience has become all too common nearly 4 years after the Great Recession ended. Yeah, right. Many Americans are still so discouraged that they've given up on the job market. Older Americans have retired early. Younger ones have enrolled in school. Others have suspended their job hunt until the employment landscape brightens. And some, like Baylor, are simply collecting disability checks. It isn't supposed to be this way. After a recession, an improving economy is supposed to bring people back into the job market. Instead, the number of people in the labor force, number of Americans in the labor force, those who have a job or are looking for one, fell by nearly 500,000 people from February to March, the government said, and the percentage of working age adults in the labor force, what's called the participation rate, fell to 63.3% last month. It's the lowest such figure since May 1979. That touches on what you were talking about. So there it is at a more human scale, a more human level of what's really, really going on. And so we can sit back and we can just applaud those major corporations who are making money hand over fist by buying back their own stock, taking loans at 0.01% or whatever. And doesn't that show that the economy is doing so well? Well, not too much.
Well, there's a little phrase in there. You had the disability payments. There was an article I read showing the amount of money that was being spent by the federal government and state governments on welfare. And it's been flat or wobbling up and down. So if you just look at the welfare, it looks as though, there aren't a lot of people going on welfare. It's pretty much, a stable rate at what it was. Then you look at the percentage of people on disability. What's happened over the past 5 or 10 years is they've redefined the disability. So it's no longer a physical disability. It's a mental disability. So if you've been looking for a job for 2 years and you're so depressed that you give up, then you file for disability. on the basis of your depression. You're perpetually depressed. You can't get a job, and so you go on disability. And the disability rate has increased by hundreds of percent. I don't remember if it was 300 or 400% over the past 10 years. Just because that's where all the people who can't find a job have to go. And so they, you know, have pain in their back, or they have you know, depression or whatever it is, and so they get on a disability rolls until they're 65 and they can get Social Security.
It's a scary and funny thing all at one time, and I'm not sure exactly how to say it any better than that, except we live in a time of conflicting evaluations. On the one hand, things are bad. On the other hand, things are good. And it's a challenge to everybody to be able to read the tea leaves and realize which one is true and which one is misleading.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know if we want to talk about the inflation indexes.
You just took the words out of my mouth.
Taking the words out of your mouth.
Well, tell you what, instead of taking the words out of my mouth, why don't you just take the inflation out of the picture and put it back in the way it's supposed to be rather than the way the government tells us.
Well, there are all kinds of different ways to measure inflation. Our inclination, the two of us anyway, is to look at the amount of quantitative easing, which is printing money by the Fed. And that's a very concrete, solid, you know, measure of what inflation is. And it's been going up at nearly a rocket pace for the past, since 2009 anyway, past 3 or 4 years. But there are various other measures of inflation. One of them is done by the American Institute for Economic Research. And they, rather than following CPI, they just have an everyday price index. And they calculate things on the basis of what people buy. You know, day to day, food and gas and clothing and, you know, all the other normal staples of life.
What a novel concept.
How's that?
What a novel concept.
So anyway, they calculate this month by month, and it's got some correlation to the CPI. But because it's just, you know, normal everyday stuff that people buy, when they annualized it over the past 10 years, they found that the average inflation rate on an annualized basis was 25%. Mm-hmm. Now, in fact, they don't take into account the seasonal adjustments in food and gasoline and so on, but they are incorporated in the thing just on the basis of averages. So you have to know something is up if they come up, you know, just on their annualized rate at 25% when the Bureau of Labor Statistics come up with a number that's 3%. And there's something amiss.
Mm. Yes, something indeed. In fact, when you mentioned to me off air that we were going to look at the AIER index, I did a little searching on my own, and I found this rather, from our view anyway, funny article published at Slate.com, and it's an article by Matthew Iglesias. He basically takes issue with the idea of the everyday price index, and let me just read it to you before I lambaste Matthew. He says, not happy with the Bureau of Labor Statistics' official measure of inflation, want a much less accurate read on price trends, then the American Institute for Economic Research has what you're looking for, an everyday price index that shows inflation is much higher than the official CPI shows. The only problem with the EPI is that it's wildly inaccurate. The reason is that some things are purchased more frequently than others. A typical family, for example, buys gasoline and groceries more than once a week. By contrast, most of us go years at a time without buying new furniture or major appliances. Mobile phones get upgraded every year or two or three. Computers get upgraded less frequently than phones, and televisions get upgraded even less frequently. This tends to introduce a psychological distortion into people's thinking whereby they overweight the importance of items that are purchased frequently and forget that other kinds of things, cars, appliances, clothing, are large elements of the overall household budget. Focusing too much on frequently purchased items can both lead you to overestimate inflation and to overestimate the variability of inflation. So, what does the EPI do? It attempts to measure the prices exclusively of things that are bought frequently. Instead of using statistics to correct intuitive misunderstandings, now you can use them to reinforce your misconceptions. Delightful, he says. And I have a little reply for Matthew. My reply to Matthew is this. The whole point of having an inflation measure is to tell you when something is going wrong. When the CPI continually tells us that everything is fine, it's not a good measure. That's the point. You want to see the crazy variations. You want to see that stuff going on because that's your signal that the economy is in trouble. So, Mr. Matthew Iglesias, wake the heck up. Wake up and recognize that, yeah, the stuff you buy more frequently is much more important. There's a good reason why you have to pay attention to the stuff you buy more frequently. And that reason is, hey, you buy it more frequently. That's the stuff people need on a regular basis. They don't need a new iPhone. I mean, measuring the whole idea of measuring inflation based on iPhones is probably the stupidest idea in the history of mankind. Yeah. I mean, first of all, iPhones and other smartphones, they're constantly coming down in price because of heavy competition. Okay, where does the CPI take into account the heavy competition? Well, it turns out that they don't. They just do their little manipulations to make everything look nice and smooth because the most important thing in their view and in your view, Matthew, is that inflation should never be shown to be gyrating. It should never be shown to be out of control because otherwise, how can you convince the stupid happy people that they should continue to be stupid and happy? Well, there's my rant for the day.
Well, I read the same rant that you did. What he does is he takes all kinds of these little numbers month to month and so on. So he says, well, you know, food prices went up, but the EPI didn't take that into account. The EPI doesn't do seasonal adjustments because motor fuel and food goes up and down month to month and so on and so forth. But he's totally ignoring the fact that the EPI is annualized, so it takes into account all the variations during the entire year and from year to year. Nevertheless, they come up with a 25% inflation rate, whereas CPI comes up at 3%. So there's just no correlation there. But let me mention one thing. I think I mentioned last week or the week before. The CPI has an interesting component, which is probably the major component of the whole index, which is equivalent rent. Equivalent rent is not what people are paying to rent an apartment or a house or whatever it is. Equivalent rent is how much you are paying based upon the value of a house amortized over 30 years. Now, what happens when the value of that house drops by 20% or 30% or 40% or 50%? Well, guess what? Your rent goes down. Isn't that marvelous? In other words, they're not looking at the mortgages you're paying. They are looking at the rental equivalent that they calculate from the market value of the housing. So they have immediately taken out almost 25% of the inflation index just by recalculating the amount you're paying to live in a house. So it's a totally hidden game as to how they do that. And yeah, it totally offsets all the other price increases that you find around your normal household.
But they also neglected to calculate in what happens when housing skyrockets. They completely underestimated because they base it on where rents are at the time that the skyrocketing occurs. And so that means over time, beyond that skyrocketing, you get a slow increase in the rent. And so it looks like everything is nice and smooth. It's distorted twice.
Yeah, both ways. Well, another distortion that's been pointed out, and it's been in the news lately, is that your budget has fallen. You don't have the same amount of income you used to have, and you used to really love apples and you Washington apples. and then switched over to Delicious apples because they were cheaper, the CPI takes that into account because they calculate what kind of, you know, how much people are spending on different kinds of apples. But if you switch from apples and say, I can't afford Delicious apples anymore, I'm going to switch to oranges because they're cheaper, or some other seasonal fruit, they don't take that into account. You know, yeah. In other words, you're cutting back on the amount of money you're spending because of the price of apples going up. But as far as the CPI is concerned, you're just buying oranges. And the price of apples stayed the same.
And that's important primarily because when they calculate the CPI, like with all these other things, they don't actually go out and measure all the prices. They do it on a survey basis. Yeah. And when you're doing it on a survey basis, it gives you a lot of latitude to decide what you're going to count and what you're not going to count. So you can be very selective about it. You can select the items that, in your opinion, show what the true rate is going to be, which, of course, is not the point of statistics at all. The point of statistics is to actually tell us what's going on, not to make it possible for us to smooth things over to say what we want them to say.
Well, and then they plug it into their supercomputers. Of course, the supercomputers have to, you know, massage the data. They eliminate all of the extremes, you know, the highs and the lows, and they come in with the average. And basically, anybody who's familiar with computer programming, especially statistical analysis, you know, the programmer walks in and says, what percentage rate do you want?
Yeah.
And he says, I'll write the program, and that's what will come out. And they could do that. And all they do is just massage the data to the point where they get the number they want to get.
Yeah, probably the best example I know of that you can give to somebody who's not a programmer to help them understand just how much latitude a programmer has is to describe what's known as a Hello World program. I know you know what that is, but listeners may not. Basically, if you're testing out a new programming language or you're testing out your own skills in trying a new language, one of the first things you do is you write a program that says Hello World. Well, among other things, you can also create a program that says 4 plus 7 is 26. You can do that with any set of numbers you want.
Yeah, sure.
Computers give you that latitude. You can make computers say anything you want.
Yeah. Yeah, well, it isn't quite that blatant.
No,
I mean, it isn't obvious to somebody that looks at the Bureau of Labor Statistics and, you know, looks at their tabulations and so on. You see numbers, but you have no idea how they got the numbers.
Right. I know it's not that simple. I know that they don't do anything that obviously, you know, coarse in order to change the numbers. But I think it's an excellent example because it helps to dispel the myth that if a computer puts the number out, it must be accurate.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's an old programming acronym, GIGO, which I'm sure you know very well.
Yeah.
It's also an accounting acronym, too. In fact, it's used in a lot of different things. But it's basically garbage in, garbage out. You put garbage in, you're going to get garbage out. You're going to get very nicely tuned garbage, but it's still garbage.
Well, that's the problem with any surveying. You always have a margin of error, and so what the computer program does from the survey data is it eliminates the outliers. So if somebody is paying, you know, let's say 10% of the population is paying twice as much as everybody else for apples, they just eliminate that number. They cut it off because that's an outlier because they want to get to that norm. And they're dealing constantly with norms, which are sort of averages, not quite. And so when they're calculating everything, they totally ignore the ups and downs that's actually in the data, even if the data is wrong. So it's
what's wrong with that, of course, is that the outliers are very often the things that tell us that things are going on, that changes are taking place that shouldn't be taking place. So the outliers aren't something that you should just ignore. They're actually something you should be paying attention to.
Yeah. We were talking about apples and oranges, and then that kind of leads us into the discussion of a chain CPI.
Well, hang on to that thought because we're about halfway through the show. Let's do our break, and then we'll pick up chain CPI after. How's that? Okay, that sounds good. So we'll take a break. We'll see you all back in a few minutes. This is the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown, here on the Progressive Radio Network. We'll be right back.
Finally, the tables are starting to turn. Talking about a revolution. It's finally the table. I said you better run, 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 run.
We're back. Dylan Wolf here on the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown, and we're going to take a look at the next measure of inflation, which is chained CPI, which sounds like it's something off of a porn site, but that's not what it is. What is it, Bill? You like that one, huh?
It's something off a porn site. It's called the Bureau of Labor Statistics porn site. No, well, change CPI is all in the news because the Republicans in, I think it was Ryan's budget, suggested choosing the CPI, replacing the CPI with the change CPI. And, of course, Obama and all the Democrats were against it. Well, this past week, Obama's budget comes out, and it says, oh, we're going to make a nice compromise with the Republicans. We're going to implement change CPI. And without knowing anything about what it is or how it does or how it's calculated or what effect it has, people know one thing, and they know that the cost of living adjustment on their benefits, whether it's Social Security or disability or welfare or whatever it is, there's a COLA. There's an increase based upon the increase in prices. So the CPI is not purely a matter of increasing consumer prices. It's also a built-in factor for everything in government, and not just benefits, but even congressmen's salaries. And every budget item that's in the normal budget has a COLA, a cost of living adjustment, every year. So when they're talking about cutting prices or cutting the budget, they're not actually reducing the amount of money they're spending. They're reducing the amount that they expect to spend with the COLA implemented. Now, the big effect of this is that rather than the COLA going up by 2.5%, with a chained CPI, it would only go up 2.2 or 2.3%. Doesn't seem like a big deal. And so for most people, the chain CPI, who really gives a darn? You know, it's a half percentage point or a tenth of a percentage point. But they obviously use it as a rhetorical device because they say, well, that's going to cut people's Social Security benefits. But it isn't cutting anything. It's just a slower rate of increase. Now, this chain CPI idea is a little more puzzling than that, because what actually happens, we were talking about the apples and oranges, and there are things where they don't account for what people's changing habits are, buying cheaper stuff rather than the more expensive stuff.
Right.
So what the chain CPI does is at the end of the year, it looks to see what people are buying. Now, if you've been buying apples all year long for a dollar a piece, and you switched over to oranges for 80 cents a piece, they say, oh, well, now you're eating oranges, and so we're going to apply the price of oranges that currently exists backwards through the past year, and we're going to look at how much the price of oranges increased. We're not going to take into account the fact that we're eating apples for 8 months out of the year. We're just going to look at the oranges and calculate the CPI based upon that. In other words, they're taking present circumstances after you've made all the adjustments and cuts in your own personal budget, and they're extending that backwards as though you'd been doing the same thing all year long. So that's how the chain CPI works, and it ends up with a smaller number than the regular CPI. And although that has only a tiny effect from year to year, it all adds up to trillions of dollars over the course of 5 or 10 years because of the trillions of dollars that are being spent on those COLA increases in the government. Now, there are people on Social Security that are getting excited about it, but it's really hard to argue that 0.2% is really worth getting passionate about. But it's a nice little gimmick that Obama can throw into his budget to reduce the costs of government for all of the payments it makes, whether it's Social Security or disability or welfare. So it's an easy political gambit.
Yeah, there's also a downside, though, to that gambit. The downside is because you're calculating based on what happened over the previous bunch of months, if you're dealing with data that just comes out now, you can't actually do your calculation until those months are over, because it's only backward looking when you're up forward.
Well, they're doing it every month, but they're looking at the previous 12 months. So they look at, you know,
right. So basically, when you're looking at today's inflation rate under this system, you're not looking at today's inflation rate. You're right. Looking at last year's inflation rate.
Right.
and if you want to know what
wait a second. It's last year's inflation rate, but it's on the products that you're now buying, yeah. which may be less expensive than what you were buying before.
Right.
So, and then the increase in the price of oranges may not have happened until October because people switch from apples to oranges. But they're applying that small increase over 2 months on oranges as though people had always been eating oranges for the previous
right.
12 months. So it's an amusing little gimmick that they've tossed in. They have another gimmick. Which doesn't work out so well. It's called CPIE, and it's an experimental thing. It's CPI for elderly people. They have a special program that they're running that calculates what the cost of health care costs and everything else for elderly people 50 or 55 and over, I think it is. And they don't really want to use that because that CPIE is almost 2% higher than the regular CPI.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, it's more expensive for old people who are living on a very restricted budget and suffering the worst consequences of consumer prices going up that are actually suffering the highest consumer price effects. And so they don't want to use that CPIE because then Social Security would have to increase by 4% instead of 2.5%. So the change CPI is a way out, and it's a tiny marginal gimmick that they can throw in that nobody's going to take much note of.
And for good reason, because what are they doing? They're taking a measure, the CPI, which is virtually useless, and they're making it even more useless.
Well, sure.
Is that even possible? I'm not sure if that's possible.
Well, it's useful to them.
Well, yeah. I mean, you got to find some way to justify what you're doing, right?
Yeah. Well, things are wonderful. They're marvelous. Just look at the numbers we created.
That's right.
You're better off than you've ever been.
And the one thing that you can always count on is those numbers came out of a computer, so you can trust them.
Of course. It's the Bureau of Labor Statistics. These are PhDs, thousands of PhDs that are they're analyzing all this information to tell you how wonderful things are.
We're from the government. Trust us.
So anyway, it's not likely to be a big issue when they consider the budget because they're not going to adopt any budgets from Obama anyway. But
yeah, they've got other concerns like what's going to happen with Obamacare because it looks like that's kind of beginning to have the wheels fall off, isn't it? I mean, it's supposedly this is when everything starts to kick into gear, and 2014 is where everything really starts to kick in, and yet now all of the little bits of numbers and pieces of information coming out are saying, warning, red light. Danger, Will Robinson, danger.
Well, and it's there are so many different aspects in terms of what's falling apart. One of the things is the government never estimates prices correctly. So they talked about setting up these insurance exchanges.
But they're so consistent about it. They're consistent, Ross.
They're always consistent. Consistently underestimate. So they decided that under Obamacare they're going to set up these state exchanges. And they said, well, you know, it's going to cost us about, maybe $2 billion to set up the exchanges. Well, no, it wasn't. Was it $2 billion or $2 trillion? I can never remember what it was. So anyway, the $2 trillion, I think it is. But it turns out, even before the exchanges are implemented, which is, I think, in October, they've already spent three-quarters of that money, and they haven't set up any exchanges yet. Now, one of the problems, and they're begging Congress for more money because they figure they could easily spend $4 trillion by the end of the year, So the problem is that the way the law was written, the Obamacare program had the states set up their own insurance exchanges. And the benefit to the states was that they were going to get all these increased subsidies and benefits, but they had to comply with all the federal regulations. Well, only 17 states decided to do that. Now they're trying to figure out how in the world the federal government is going to set up these exchanges in 33 other states. They don't have the money to do it. They never anticipated that that many states were going to just refuse to set up the insurance exchanges. So that's one aspect that is causing all manner of headaches. And even in the administration, there are headaches because they have to take money out of other programs. So they got like a prevention program. They're taking a few, $100 billion out of that. And, other health care programs they're cutting back on. This is over and above the sequester. Just for the purpose of paying for these federal exchanges in the various states that have declined to do it. Now, they've got another little gimmick that's going to hit the courts. They decided, well, let's have the IRS impose a user tax on everybody who uses the exchange. Now, this is over and above all the other taxes that are already in Obamacare. So the IRS just arbitrarily said, yeah, we're going to charge a fee if the federal government has to set up the exchange because we're going to have to do all the paperwork. And so, unfortunately, there's nothing in the law that allows them to do that. And so there are a half dozen different states that have got a case headed for the Supreme Court saying the IRS can't impose this fee just totally arbitrarily because it needs the money. It has to actually have it in law. And the way Obamacare was written, there was no money for any federal exchanges. So that's one aspect of what's falling apart. But there are a lot of other aspects to that. For example, one of the things is that they're just recognizing that because of all of the requirements they put in Obamacare, in order to cover so many different benefits under even the minimum insurance coverage plan that's supposed to be in the exchanges, they're going to have to increase the premiums. The insurance companies are going to have to increase their premiums by anywhere from 10 to 30% minimum in order to cover the costs of the people and the benefits that they have to cover. So consequentially, yeah, you're going to insure 80 million more people, but they're going to be paying 50% more, 100% more than they would have been paying under the old system. So it's hardly a bargain.
It's hardly a bargain, and it also directly flies in the face of what the pro-Obamacare advocates kept telling us over and over again, which was, no, this is not going to drive the cost of medical care up even higher. Well, guess what?
Yeah, and if you have a policy, you're going to be able to keep it if you like it, as long as you're willing to pay the higher premiums. Because now we're going to cover all men for contraceptives.
I'm guessing that if you have like a 30% increase and it's due to regulation, then probably what you do is you end up massaging the numbers to not count regulation because that way it won't make the increase look so big.
It's all those big bad insurance companies. They're just trying to make money. How dare they?
Right. And I'm no fan of insurance companies, don't get me wrong. But, I mean, because they are big corporations, let's be perfectly honest.
they can't evade the reality. I mean, if they put Obamacare in and they do all these fantastic benefits and they force the insurance companies to do it below their costs, the insurance companies are all going to go broke. And then guess what we get? We get one payer. Where the federal
There's another aspect here, too. And the other aspect is that there's that little small penalty, which is hardly even a penalty, $200 or $300 for the year if you don't have insurance when the whole thing finally kicks in.
No, it's not a penalty. It's not a penalty. It's a tax.
Oh, it's a tax. I'm sorry.
It's penal tax.
Penal tax, right? But anyway, the tax is not a penalty. I keep thinking to myself, I wonder how many people are going to opt for that, because it's gotten to the point now where you can't even buy like a $10,000 deductible policy that doesn't start skyrocketing. So, you know, if people finally decide that enough is enough and they're going to opt out, I wonder what the numbers are going to be. I have a sneaking suspicion it's going to be very, very high. And if it's very high, what that ends up doing, among other things, is it ends up skyrocketing hospitalization costs. Because, according to the law, and it's written in a number of different laws, federal and state level both, you can't be denied medical care just because you're uninsured. The quality of medical care you're going to get, the options you're going to get are going to be limited, but you can't be denied medical care.
Well, so not only that.
So consider what happens when you have a whole population, a brand new population of people claiming that they can't pay for the medical care because they can't afford the insurance anymore. That means that they're all going into the emergency room to get their treatment, which is the most expensive form of medical care you can get.
Right. The other aspect is that because they are not allowed under Obamacare to deny insurance because people have pre-existing conditions, why not just pay the penalty until you get sick?
Yeah.
And then once you're sick, you buy the insurance, pays for all of the expenses.
Which
you get all the benefits.
Emergency room, but still, you know.
Yeah, well, you know, but this doesn't just cover emergency rooms. The insurance is going to cover them for all kinds of all these fantastic benefits that Obamacare requires.
And that's
so you buy your insurance at the last minute and get all these benefits, and then as soon as you're better, you cancel the insurance and pay the penalty.
Right, and that's where the insurance companies going broke comes in, like you were talking about.
Yeah, right.
Yes, it's a wonderful system. I wonder how long before it actually completely collapses. I'm betting it's going to be less than a two-year period, maybe even a year. What do you think?
Something like that. The thing that they're going to have to deal with is that because Obamacare reduces the amount of compensation, this was their cost savings element, it reduces the amount they pay doctors. Doctors more and more are realizing that they're going to be providing services at these reduced prices next year, and they're not going to make any money. So they're either going to cash payments or they're just going out of business. They're closing down. So you're not going to have the government forcing people to practice medicine. So the availability of medical care is going to just take a huge drop in the next year.
And there's also another interesting aspect to all this, because since Obamacare and the implementation of it is, understandably, somewhat controversial, it turns out that the White House is actually organizing plans to market Obamacare to the uninsured. And there was a little piece in investors.com that was rather quite amusing, because it reports that the details of what the White House plans to do, how it plans to market Obamacare to the uninsured, reveals that it turns out most of them don't want the administration to try to force them to buy it.
Well, whole principle behind Obamacare is you force everybody to buy insurance, and the young and healthy that don't want it and don't need it make up 40% of the people who are the uninsured. They don't want it. They have a low motivation to enroll psychologically and physically. They're, you know, not likely to need medical care for, you know, 10, 20, whatever years. And so they're starting this marketing program to explain to young people how fantastic it is to pay for something you'll never take advantage of.
and that's a rather difficult sell. I mean, I know you've had some marketing background. I do a lot of marketing. I can tell you, trying to get somebody to buy something at a high price for a low return is a really tough sell.
That's true. Yeah, but see, the idea is he forces young and healthy people to get insured, or they have to pay the penal tax, and that's where the money was coming from. You know, all along is to force the young people and the healthy people to pay for the old and the sick. That's the whole purpose, the whole principle behind Obamacare.
Oops. Well, we got about 5 minutes left, and we've been making fun and having fun with a lot of very sad news. There's too many items left on our list, so let's go for some happy news. This is one that we've kind of been carrying along for quite some time now, and it's a little Google, I'm not sure what to call it. It's a Google funny, let's call it that. And why don't you just tell the story about that one, Bill?
No, it was an April Fool's joke. Google decided that they were going to have not just Google Maps and Google this and Google that, but they were going to have Google Knows. They were going to create an a database of scents so that you could sniff different odors from your computer. So they put up this fantastic, beautiful program was released in beta mode on April 1st. And, explained how you push this special key on your computer and you can smell strawberries or roses or chocolate or whatever you want. Of course, it was all total fake, but it was funny. And the related item to that was that there's one country, at least, Germany, that is considering adding odor, a unique smell, to all of its money as part of the effort to combat fake money. They were going to make, they never hadn't decided what they were going to make it smell like. I guess you'd pick out a favorite smell for your currency. But this was anti-counterfeiting measure. They were going to make their money with an odor, stinky money.
I think they made a mistake, actually. I think what they should have done is gone over to Paris, because we all know that's where the best designers are.
Uh-huh.
If you want to make something that has a nice, light scent, an attractive scent, you want to go to Fabergé. You don't want to go to the Deutsche Bank Mint, because the most that you're likely to find there is like the smell of a burning hard drive from the computer that just burned out. Doesn't that kind of work?
Well, they would probably have to come up with some kind of a unique scent. I mean, it wouldn't be a Fabergé scent or something like that in this commercial.
Well, they're all unique.
It would have to be something cheap, like lemon.
No,
we're going to have lemon money.
Because if it's cheap, that means anybody can do it. So it becomes easy for the counterfeiters to counterfeit the smell. No, it's got to be a patented smell.
What do you suggest as an odor that hasn't been patented yet? we'll avoid the eschatological terms here.
I also like the Google Knows. Google Knows has a nice double meaning, because the homonym of knows is knows, as in having knowledge. So Google Knows.
Yes, Google Knows.
And Google, of course, is trying to map the entire universe of human knowledge. So it's rather appropriate that they call it Google Knows.
It knows the nose.
Well, I just have one other question. Now, I didn't know all of what you're going to report on that one. I usually just get the headlines. And the last word in the headline was zombies. What did zombies have to do with this?
Well, we were talking about zombie mortgages a few weeks back, and I happened to bump into a little article from California State University, and it was a solicitation for papers. You know, they do this whole time. We want a paper on microbiology, whatever it is. So in this particular case, they're soliciting abstracts for the economics of the undead. The editors seek abstracts for essays exploring the relationship between economics and zombies, especially zombies, but also vampires. The chosen essays will appear in a collection to be published by Rowan and Littlefield. Okay? Possible topics for these essays. Supply and demand in the market for blood. The operation of zombie labor markets, the political economy of responding to undead threats, macroeconomic recovery after a zombie apocalypse. What zombie and vampire behavior tell us about the rational choice modeling of economic systems?
So is this Ben Bernanke's new plan to fight inflation? Is that what this is?
Yeah, that's what it is. It's the undead economics. Well, it reminded me back when Reagan was in office and they were What was the term? It wasn't zombie economics.
It was voodoo economics.
Yeah, there you go. And so this is the upgrade on the voodoo economics.
Well, voodoo economics is how you go and shoot down the zombie economics, you know.
Yeah, well, you can shoot down the zombie economics, but it does vampires you got to worry about.
And that brings us to the end of the program. That, I think, is a perfect time to end the whole thing. What do you think?
There you go.
So we'll see you all next time here on the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown. Goodbye, everybody.